On Trauma, Shadow, and Flawed Leadership by Heather Platt. It happened repeatedly in my youth. I'd come home from a friend's house and walk into the house to find nobody there. I'd look in all of the rooms, start to get that panicky feeling, and then run out to the farmyard to see if somebody was in the barn or cattle pasture. Suddenly, I was desperate to know that somebody was home, that they hadn't all abandoned me. I only felt secure when I heard my dad's voice or spotted my mom in the garden. It was the end times I was most afraid of, being left behind when the rapture came. Every person I know who's grown up in an evangelical home has a similar memory. What if they've all gone and we didn't get taken with them? What if we weren't Christian enough? What if we haven't sufficiently confessed our sins and will be denied entry into heaven? There's a certain trauma that gets left in a person's body when you grow up with that fear. There's a heightened awareness that threads through your nervous system, reminding you always that you have to be good enough, obedient enough, and repentant enough to make the cut when the second coming suddenly separates the saved from the unsaved. It's taken me a long time to recognize how much of that early conditioning has left me with an easily triggered fear of being found out to be sinful, wrong, or bad. To be bad is to be separated from God, shunned from your community, and at risk of spending an eternity in the fires of hell. Even long after you stop believing in hell, the trauma stays rooted in your body. Abandonment, shame, shunning, pain, death. This is what my amygdala still tries to convince me in moments when it's triggered into fight, flight, freeze, or fawn, are the consequences of being bad. I've been wondering lately whether this isn't just a personal experience, the result of being raised in an evangelical home, but a collective one. How much have we all been socialized into this kind of reactivity, even those not raised in evangelicalism? How much of that trauma remains deeply and subconsciously rooted in our culture here in North America and elsewhere, given the fact that we are ostensibly Christian nations colonized by countries where Christianity was the dominant religion? How much have we internalized the fear of separation and abandonment that a sin doctrine embeds in a culture even long after it's not the central narrative? There's a pattern that I've witnessed over and over again when I teach the Holding Space Practitioner Program. People show up eager to learn about holding space for others, and somewhere around Module 2 on holding space for yourself, they come face to face with their own biases, trauma, blind spots, and shadow. Suddenly, whoa, I start getting remarks about how hard the work has become and how they need more time. We've lengthened this module for that reason, and the resistance shows up. Some push back, some want to abandon ship, some create conflict. Many end up begrudgingly thanking me for nudging them into work that they were avoiding doing, but first they have to fight it. It's hard to look into your own shadow. It's painful and shame-inducing to suddenly have to face your biases, blind spots, and blunders. It's also, if my theory is right, trauma-inducing. It triggers a deeply rooted, culturally sanctioned, subconscious fear that we will be abandoned, shunned, and sent out of the kingdom. We'll lose our standing in the community. We'll risk an eternity of pain and separation, and we might even be put to death. Or at least that's what the amygdala believes. It's why we have things like white fragility. Though I appreciate what this writer says about renaming it white flammability. There's a link in the blog if you're interested. People who've convinced themselves they are good people, in good standing with their community, are suddenly sent into spasms when their biases and blind spots are revealed. They can't fathom the fact that they are capable of causing harm. They haven't been equipped to hold space for their own shame. Subconsciously, they're terrified that they will be abandoned and, at worst, banished from the kingdom. It's also why we've developed such a punitive legal system in our culture. We might call it a justice system, and that's in quotes, but it's really not about justice. It's about shaming, blaming, and punishing those who do wrong. It's about creating separation from those of us who are seen to be, quote, upstanding citizens, and those who are criminals. It's about sending people out of our communities and abandoning them in prisons so that we can hide the collective shadow in our culture. Out of fear of our own shadow, we call out those with more obvious shadows, or those marginalized by the dominant culture and made to look like they are bad, and we project our shame onto them. Because of this collective fear of being wrong, we've not only punished the transgressors, but we've also elevated and idolized those with curated lives who look like they've managed to transcend the messiness that the rest of us get stuck in. We overlook the cracks in those we want to emulate because we want to see the polished life, and we want to believe that it's possible for us too to live untarnished lives. We project our unhealthy aspirations and expectations of ourselves onto those who appear most worthy of our adoration. Social media makes this even more tempting because it allows us unprecedented access into our heroes' lives and opinions. When you find yourself in a position of influence like that, with people projecting their ideals onto you, it becomes surprisingly tempting to give them what they want. If they give you money to teach them how to live a charmed and curated life like yours, or to model it on screen, it's even more tempting. The money allows you to put even more polish on your life, so it perpetuates the cycle. Meanwhile, your own trauma and fear of abandonment is at play, so you work extra hard at meeting people's expectations of you for fear of being found out and suddenly shunned and left behind. Unfortunately, that charmed place on a pedestal rarely lasts. People find the cracks in your facade, and when they start poking around, they find that those cracks are really deep, dark chasms of shadow. And then because they feel betrayed by you, because you no longer give them hope that a shadow-free life is possible, they tear you down with a vengeance. That's what cancel culture is all about. Sadly, if those influencers had known early on in their development that the uncomfortable shadow work that they avoided is what could have saved them from the destructiveness of the teardown, they might have found themselves on a different trajectory. Sure, they wouldn't have found the same level of celebrity and status, but they would have found something much better and longer lasting, authentic community. Relationships rooted in truth-telling and vulnerability are worth a lot more than those shallowly rooted in performance. In recent months, with Black Lives Matter at the forefront of our consciousness, we've seen several people, especially in the coaching and personal development world, with large followings and lots of influence, whose cracks have been revealed. People are pointing out the lack of consciousness around anti-racism and anti-oppression and revealing where harm has been done to the marginalized in their communities. Some of them, in avoidance of the shame of being called out, use gaslighting to shame and reject anyone who might challenge them. Some teach spiritual bypassing as a way of avoiding the darkness and keeping their followers in a state of compliance and fake peace. Some of these leaders, sadly, have developed cult-like followings, where people are shamed by others in the group for daring to challenge what their leader says. As Alexandra Stein has pointed out in Terror, Love, and Brainwashing, these leaders manipulate their followers into unhealthy attachment systems, where followers will do anything to stay connected to the leader because of the way that their needs are met in the community. The leaders manipulate the trauma coursing through our culture, reminding people that they will be rejected if they step out of line, if they point out the flaws in the leader or what's being taught within the community. The trauma bond floods the nervous system and makes it nearly impossible for people to think clearly and notice how messed up the leader, community, and/or belief system is. The only solution, as I see it, is for us to work to heal the collective trauma and begin to create greater space in our culture for shadow work. We need to make it acceptable to speak of our mistakes, to admit our biases, to own up to the ways in which we cause harm because of our trauma and social conditioning. We also need to build collective systems in which we learn how to co-regulate in those moments when we are triggered so that we don't cause so much harm as a result. We also need to change our collective views about leadership. When leaders and influencers can be flawed and vulnerable, when they don't feel the pressure to meet unrealistic expectations, and when they are embedded into communities that both support them and hold them accountable, then there is less inclination for them to become abusive when their biases and blind spots are pointed out. They don't have to hide their shadows because they've never pretended they didn't have them. In just a few weeks, we'll be launching the Center for Holding Space. One of the reasons why I'm going into partnership and launching this instead of building it alone is that I want to be intentional about building a structure that doesn't elevate me into an unrealistic position of leadership and influence. I don't want to be the influencer who cracks under the pressure of meeting other people's expectations. I want to be able to continue to reveal my shadow, and I want to be held accountable for the ways my biases and blind spots get in the way of the work. I don't want my trauma, my deeply held fear of being found out to be bad, to be running the show and separating me from the humanity of myself and those in community. I want to be imperfect, and I want to keep striving to welcome imperfect people into the circle with me. My partner, Krista, is very good at supporting me and helping me stay grounded and honest. We have built a solid relationship of trust in which neither of us has to be performative or defensive of our flaws. We are also growing an incredible team of people that is eager to support this work as it grows, and they're equally committed to showing up flawed and vulnerable alongside us. In building a solid foundation for our business, we recently worked through a conscious contract with our lawyer in which we developed a co-founders agreement that will help us work through conflict and hold space for the shadow when it shows up in ourselves and our business. We'll hold each other accountable for doing the messy work and for staying in the discomfort long enough for transformation to happen. We are excited to welcome you, our readers, clients, and friends, into this space we are creating. We want to hold space for your imperfections. We want to create a space of healing where trauma isn't shamed and nobody is shunned for being wrong. Whenever I teach my workshops on holding space, I warn people that there will likely be a moment when they have to face their own shadow and their discomfort might make them want to run from the room. You're allowed to step out of the room if you need to, I say, but know that you are always welcome back. We will hold the space for you to return. That's what I want for the Center for Holding Space to be, a place where people can peer into their shadows and trust that even if they run away, they're still welcome back in the room. Because when people come back to meet themselves in the circle, that's when the real healing happens.